Chapter 8, Doctrinal Formulas. While it is possible to lose sight of the spirit of Buddhism among the multifariousness of its forms, it is no less possible to lose the spirit by repudiating the forms prematurely. The Buddha Amitayus, infinite life, bears in his hands a jar containing the nectar of immortality. Jar without nectar is useless, but nectar without jar to contain it will only be spilled and wasted. After exhibiting as clearly as possible the spirit of Buddhism, we have therefore to relate it to its doctrinal embodiment, as well as to indicate the origin, true nature, and proper function of that embodiment. As already related, it was out of compassion that the newly enlightened Lord decided to make known to mankind the truth he had penetrated. Again, when a few months later he sent forth the 60 enlightened disciples, he charged them to go forth and proclaim the Dharma out of compassion for the world. This love or compassion, which, as we have just seen, constitutes with illumination and freedom the essence of Buddhism, brings the enlightened into communication, even into communion, with the unenlightened mind. The medium of this communication is the formulated Dharma. This consists in the first place of words and concepts. But the fact that these were not invented by the Buddha and can be traced in the records of pre-Buddhist teachings does not justify such sweeping conclusions as the Buddha was influenced by the Upanishads, or Buddhism is an offshoot of Hinduism. One might just as well maintain that Shakespeare copied his plays from obscure early Elizabethan dramatists, on the grounds that he made use of the same words and drew upon the same general stock of ideas as they did. Whatever words and concepts constitute the formulated Dharma, it is in fact essentially a medium for the communication to mankind of a unique and ineffable experience, the Buddha's experience of illumination, freedom, love, as well as an attempt to induce all who heard the words and understood the concepts to participate in it themselves by having immediate and vigorous recourse to such methods as he in his wisdom could devise. As such, the Dharma is not an end in itself, but a means to an end. In the Majjhima Nikaya, the Buddha compares his teaching to the raft used for crossing a great stretch of water, roundly declaring that to burden oneself with it after its work is done is sheer foolishness. The comparison is doubly apposite. It brings out not only the more obvious point to which reference has just been made, but also the subtler one, that although the Dharma is only a means, it is an indispensable means. The point is important. Only too often do those with a merely theoretical understanding of the instrumental value of the Dharma assume themselves to be thereby exempted from the necessity of having effective recourse to it as the veritable means of enlightenment. This is to abandon the raft before one has even started crossing the water. A middle path should be followed. One must understand that a collection of sticks only constitutes a raft through the existence of the further shore, and it is only by means of the raft that the further shore can actually be reached. Spirit and letter are interdependent. Divorced from the living spirit of the Master's teaching, the letter of the Dharma, however faithfully transmitted, is dead, a thing of idle words and empty concepts. Separated from its concrete embodiment in the letter, the spirit of the Dharma, however exalted, lacking a medium of communication, is rendered inoperative. In writing about Buddhism, one should therefore be careful to pay equal attention to both aspects. The ideal account would in fact show spiritual experiences crystallizing into concrete doctrinal and disciplinary forms, and these resolving themselves back into spiritual experiences. Full justice would then be done both to the letter and to the spirit of the tradition. What is true of the whole is no less true of its parts. for reasons mainly mnemonic and pedagogic. Much of the recorded Dharma has come down to us in the shape of stereotype formulas and numbered lists of doctrinal terms. Thus, we have the three characteristics, tri lakshana, the four Aryan truths, kata aryasata, the five groups, pancha skanda, the six bases, saddhayatana, the seven factors of enlightenment, sapta bodhiyanga, the Aryan Eightfold Path, Arya Astangika Marga, the nine transcendental states, Nava Lokuttara Dharma, the ten perfections, Dasha Paramita, the 12 links, Dvadasa Pratnidana, the 37 wings of enlightenment, Bodhipaksha Dharma, and hundreds more. After the Parinirvana of the Buddha, the drawing up of such lists, especially of mental states, became almost an obsession with a section of his followers. And though a reaction eventually set in, Indian Buddhism was hardly ever free from this tendency. The result is that, having been compiled under such auspices, almost the whole of the Hinayana and much of the Mahayana canonical literature has come down to us in an artificial, stereotyped form, which, as one can see from short passages which proved unamenable to such treatment, is often at variance with the spiritual vitality of the message it enshrines. This is not to say that, given the conditions under which it had to be transmitted, the Dharma could not have been handed down in any other manner, or that we should not feel profoundly grateful to the compilers and codifiers who gave it such an unattractive but durable shape. Yet, for the student of Buddhism, and even more acutely for the writer, the existence of so many doctrinal formulas does constitute a problem. What is one to do with them all? Some writers, of course, ignore them and give an arbitrary account of what they imagine the Buddha taught. Others, like the author of Atta-rasa-rasi-dipani, which purports to be an aid to meditation, include as many as possible without giving a thought to what they really mean. The first procedure is justifiable only if, like the Buddha, one has oneself crossed to the other shore and can speak out of the depths of one's own enlightenment experience. The second, if one is compiling a glossary of Buddhist terms. Once again, a middle path should be pursued. For the student of Buddhism to try to understand the Dharma without having mastered at least all the more important doctrinal terms would be like a pianist attempting to play the Moonlight Sonata who had never bothered to practice any scales. Nevertheless, scales are not sonatas, and the student should not commit the mistake of thinking that knowing by heart the doctrinal categories of Buddhism in Pali or Sanskrit or any other language is the same thing as a true understanding of the Dharma. The Balanced writer on Buddhism follows a similar course. While not obtruding doctrinal formulas ostentatiously on the reader for their own sake, he does not seek in his expositions to eschew the use of them altogether. The principal formulas he will delineate with precision and clarity, drawing attention to their importance for the history of Buddhist thought. At the same time, instead of treating them so literally that they become, as it were, solid and opaque, he will enable them to fulfil their true function by refining them to so high a degree of transparency that through them the radiance of the enlightenment experience shines with the minimum of obstruction.